Welcome to the program. I'm Jeff Shechtman. There are those places that you just have to say their name, and they instantly conjure up images and fantasies. The South of France, Aspen, Venice, Rome, New York City, and Beverly Hills, California. It's an improbable city, a gilded enclave in the midst of the cacophony of Los Angeles. But what's just as remarkable is that it has preserved its identity even as LA has changed and changed and changed again. How this city came to be and why that history has remained part of its cultural DNA is a story told by my guest Nancy Clare in her new book, The Battle for Beverly Hills. Nancy Clare is a Southern California-based journalist and a writer. She spent 11 years as editor of Los Angeles Magazine and most recently editor-in-chief of the award-winning LA. She's also contributed to articles for the Los Angeles Times, The Hollywood Reporter, and numerous other publications. She's the chief interviewer for the podcast Speaking of Mysteries, and it is my pleasure to welcome Nancy Clare here to talk about the battle for Beverly Hills, a city's independence and the birth of celebrity politics. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for asking me. I'm delighted to be talking to you.
Well, it's great to have you here. When we talk about Beverly Hills, it is this kind of improbable place, this little city in the midst of so much of Los Angeles. Talk a little bit about its earliest days, about how the city itself came to be.
Well, like many places in California, it started out as a land grant, which its Spanish name, which I won't try, is the place of the gathering of the waters, because something that Beverly Hills had that much of the Los Angeles basin does not is groundwater. And so it was purchased by a Dr. Pruce who tried to make it a sheep farm. He failed and went on to found Anaheim. It was purchased by Don Benito Wilson and Henry Hancock to look for oil. They didn't find any. And they finally, it was purchased by Hamel and Denker, who were two hoteliers in downtown Los Angeles. And they grew lima beans, and they tried to subdivide it. They wanted to call it Morocco. And in 1900, it was purchased by the Amalgamated Oil Company with Burton Green and Henry Huntington and Max Whittier and Canfield as some of the principals. And those are pretty big names in oil exploration down here in Los Angeles, Doheny as well.
Right.
And they didn't find oil, but they did find water. And Burton Green and Canfield decided that it should be a community. And so that was the beginning. That was about 1900. 1912, they decided they needed to entice buyers to their new city. So they had the Beverly Hills Hotel built. They gave the land and a sizable budget to Margaret and Stanley Anderson, who were the original owners. They built this magnificent hotel, and, you know, if you build it, they will come. People came and started to buy property, and in 1914, 2 years after the hotel was completed, they incorporated. It wasn't quite legal. Henry Huntington trained in enough people to make them legal to vote for cityhood, and then after that, trucked them out. But it was a city of the sixth class, according to the laws of the state of California. And it was incorporated, I believe, January 28th, 1914.
One of the things that would happen in Los Angeles is that, particularly around this period and in really into the early 20s, a lot of these small cities that had been incorporated were really being subsumed into the larger Los Angeles. Talk a little about that.
Well, it was the siren call of water.
Right.
In 1913, William Mulholland completed his magnificent, or at least us in the South, we think it's magnificent, project, the Los Angeles Aqueduct, which brought water from the eastern slope of the Sierra into Los Angeles. And it was determined by the laws of the city, because this aqueduct is owned by the Department of Water and Power, which is a municipal entity. It's not a private water company. it was decided that the laws did not permit selling the water or building any kind of structures to convey the water to other cities. And so this was something that most people, most cities and unincorporated areas couldn't resist. They wanted water, and they needed it. Southern California doesn't have a lot of water. And it cities like Hollywood. Hollywood was an independent city between 1903 and 1910. They couldn't hold out. They needed, you know, they needed the water, and they needed the other city services that Los Angeles could provide, including, you know, sewage and trash collection, just the sort of nitty-gritty of municipal life. Other cities that, as a matter of fact, Beverly Hills is the only city that voted down annexation, and it stuck. The city of Venice voted down annexation once, and the city fathers just couldn't deal with that, and so they insisted on a second vote, and annexation was voted on. It was just very hard to resist being able to know that you were going to have water.
How much of the fact that Beverly Hills was able to fight off annexation came from the fact that it had its own water sources?
Well, I think that was a big factor. It was easy for the Rodeo Land and Water Company to get into the water business when they wanted to sell land, and a little bit harder to sustain it. It was going to take money, and it was going to take building a waterworks in order to make the water. They had some good, clean, artesian spring water that came from the northern part of the city, which they collected in Franklin Reservoir in the Santa Monica Mountains. When they needed more water, they were going to have to drill for it further south in the area of La Cienega, which, of course, is Spanish for the swamp. That water was going to have to be treated. It was sulfurous. It was going to cost money, and Rodeo didn't want to spend it. But I think the fact that they had water made it easier for them. But it was more than that. There was the whole birth of celebrity politics thing. Celebrities lived there, and they didn't want to be part of Los Angeles, which was just as corrupt as any other big city in America by the early 1920s, right, in the era of Prohibition.
What was it about Beverly Hills as an enclave that these celebrities liked so much? Talk about that.
I think that they liked the fact that the police department had three members. They did their patrols on bicycles, and I think there was one motorcycle that they shared at that time. They also, it's a multifaceted thing. When many of these celebrities first arrived as the motion picture industry migrated from the East Coast to Southern California, they came upon signs that said, you know, no dogs, no Jews, no movie. And by that, they meant no movie actors or people that worked in the film industry. And I think that sunk in as many of them became famous: Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks. Although Mary Pickford and Doug, those three were already famous, they can't help but have seen these signs. They wanted to live somewhere where they could be not be subject to a social register kind of criteria, where Douglas Fairbanks was half Jewish, and he was very, very concerned with keeping that a secret. Beverly Hills was brand new, just like them. Movie stars were brand new. Beverly Hills was brand new. It was very fortuitous meeting. They could do whatever they wanted there. They had the smaller police force. The police force could keep the sort of voracious press at bay. And there were seven newspapers in Los Angeles in the early 1920s. And so it offered them a respite. It offered them a place. And I think that's something that has continued to this day. I think celebrity understands celebrity, and the rest of us can only look at it and wonder what it is. It's so amorphous and different.
One of the other aspects that I think a lot of people don't understand, and you talk about the signs that they saw, that in much of L.A. at that period of time, there was an awful lot of prejudice and bigotry and really very different than the L.A. we might think of today.
Well, yes. I mean, it seems as though the people that started to pour into Los Angeles in the teens and 20s, and the population essentially doubled between 1920 and 1930, and the big influx started after the aqueduct opened and houses started to be built. They wanted to replicate what they had left in the East Coast and the Midwest and very much in the South. And they did. You know, African Americans could only live in off of Central Avenue. Jews weren't really welcome anywhere. And in spite of the fact that all of California had been first Spanish and then Mexican until the middle part of the 19th century, they didn't want the Hispanics anywhere either. It really, you know, they had the opportunity to have a much more integrated city from the get-go, and they just blew it.
There was this huge influence, as you say. The South was part of it, but also the Midwest, as you mentioned, was a huge part of it. I think there were probably more people from Nebraska at one point than any place else.
And that includes Harold. That includes two of the people, celebrities in Beverly Hills, that fought off annexation. Fred Niblow and Harold Lloyd were both originally from Nebraska. Yes, and Hollywood had been founded by the Wilcoxes, and they were Christian teetotalers, and I believe they were from Kansas. And this is the kind of thing they wanted to replicate, this sort of white, Christian, teetotaling, God-fearing society, and that made for an interesting clash, considering that for 300 years, California had been either Spanish or Mexican. You know, different language, different laws, different religions. It was, you know, it was roiling. That's how I described it.
When these celebrities, Fairbanks, Pickford, Harold Lloyd, so many of the others, got involved in this fight to prevent annexation, to what extent did they worry about putting their celebrity on the line for what was essentially a political cause?
Well, it was. I think they were motivated by self-interest, and I think they were led by Mary Pickford. And, you know, it's easy to look back on Mary Pickford and think that she was quite quaint, but she really was revolutionary. I mean, she understood the impact of the motion picture industry early on. And more importantly, she understood her influence. She was asked by William McAdoo, who was Secretary of the Treasury for Woodrow Wilson, to, along with Douglas Fairbanks, who was her lover but not her husband, and Charlie Chaplin and an East Coast-based actress named Marie Dressler, to help sell Liberty Loan, or which is what they called the war bonds during World War One, and she sold millions and millions of dollars of war bonds in the teens, and that, you know, translated into billions of dollars in today's money. And so she got it. She understood that even though these people didn't know her, they knew the roles she played, and they knew that they wanted to see her and be near her. She auctioned off one of her curls in Chicago for $15,000 to raise money for the war bonds. And so she understood her influence, but she was also smart enough to understand that in the case of Beverly Hills, that sort of mass, you know, gathering of people was not what was needed. What was needed was a low-key, door-to-door, one-on-one interaction to get people to vote against the annexation. And when you think about it, and I think this was the secret sauce, nobody is going to refuse to let Mary Pickford or Douglas Fairbanks or Rudolph Valentino in the door. They don't need to introduce themselves. Everybody knew who they were. And it was an instant entree. And I think that's something that celebrities learned from this initial experience. But it was very much about self-interest for Mary Pickford.
Right.
There had been three major scandals that sort of brushed by her. Her sister-in-law died of accidental poisoning, drinking her brother's mercury bichloride, which he used as a topical treatment for his syphilis. Then there was the Roscoe Arbuckle trials in San Francisco, and finally Desmond Taylor's murder in 1922. These were scandals, and she was very conscious of her public persona and wanted to keep scandal at bay. And the best way to do that, in her mind, was to keep the press at bay. And the best way to do that was to live in a municipality where she was the queen.
What was their argument as they went to their neighbors and to friends and to those that weren't celebrities in Beverly Hills? What was their argument against annexation?
Well, the first thing they had to do was convince everybody that one day that they weren't going to walk into their kitchen, turn on the faucet, and it would be dry. They worked with the city fathers, including Stanley Anderson and Silsby Spaulding, who was the president of the, they called it the Board of Trustees, the Beverly Hills Board of Trustees, and that was their city government. They worked with those two to understand that there was available water, and they would also have more control over the school system. The first skirmish Beverly Hills had with the County of Los Angeles was over the schools. They wanted to expand their schools, and the county said no. So they sort of got a hint of what was going to happen if they joined up with Los Angeles and had the Los Angeles City control their schools. And Silsby Spaulding was a very, very smart man. You have to understand, everybody in Beverly Hills was wealthy. This was not convincing otherwise, people that sort of were on the edge. These were all wealthy people. Silsby Spaulding was an oil magnate. He owned, he actually owned almost as many shares in the Rodeo Land and Water Company as Burton Green. So he had a foot in both camps. But his vision was that the land values would remain consistent if they remained and grow if they remained a separate city, that they would have more control. Everybody looked at what happened in Hollywood. Any promises that were made to maintain any semblance of this garden city before its annexation was just completely ignored. Plus, it could cost them money. There was no guarantee. Once they voted, the way it worked is they had to vote for annexation and then Los Angeles had to vote to accept them. And in the law is language that says that they could be assessed additional fees. And that could have cost them lots and lots of money.
What role, if any, did developers play on either side of this battle?
Well, the developers were the Rodeo Land and Water Company, and their motto that they put on banners that went across the street and they in shop windows was annexation or stagnation. Their argument was that the city of Beverly Hills could not grow anymore because there was no more water. Interestingly, they had had a study done by a hydraulic engineer named Lippincott, and Lippincott reports that no, there's tons of water. It just has to be, there have to be wells dropped, and it will have to be treated. Rodeo Land and Water Company kept that a secret. So all of the developers, with the exception of Silsby Spaulding, and most of the real estate people, whose business, of course, was selling lots, and people didn't want to build unless they knew there was going to be water, were pro-annexation, and the celebrities and a few key citizens, the non-celebrity citizens, were against annexation.
Who were the celebrities that were on the other side of the battle, if any?
I don't think there were any. I think all of the celebrities were pro or anti-annexation, and that's covered in the Hearst had a paper in Los Angeles called the Los Angeles Examiner, and he used to just skewer them. You know, on the voting day, he said, you know, the celebrities, all of whom were anti-annexation, you know, rolled down from their palatial piles to the voting precinct to cast their ballots against annexation. I think it was pretty uniform that they didn't want to be part of Los Angeles, and I think Mary Pickford had been extremely effective in making that argument.
Talk about the fact that once they succeeded in this first battle, the extent to which they had to continue to be eternally vigilant about this.
I think they had to be eternally vigilant about their own privacy, and in that regard, they stayed involved in the city. I don't think there was another attempt to annex, if that's what you meant. Mm-hmm. But the city of Beverly Hills was not afraid to go toe-to-toe with Los Angeles pretty much from the get-go. And after annexation was voted down, they had no problem saying no to freeways. There are no freeways that go in or out of Beverly Hills. And as a city, that was their right. And they're very reluctant to even allow any kind of mass transit. Right. For the first time, one of Los Angeles' subways is going to go through Beverly Hills. And there's a lot of consternation in the city about it. They have a much lower density. You know, the Beverly Hills has under 35,000 residents, and Los Angeles, which completely surrounds it, has 3.9 million. So it's a very, you know, bucolic, lots are still big, apartments are low rise. I think they can't be higher than four stories. There are very few high rise buildings, and they are limited to Wilshire Boulevard. So, it's, you know, it's a very different place than Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And that's what they wanted to maintain.
What was the takeaway from this with respect to celebrities and politics?
Well, I like to think that this campaign by Mary Pickford and her, you know, like I call them the Beverly Hills Eight or Team Anti-Annexation, I think celebrity politics might have progressed differently had she lost. You know, all they have is their name and their reputation, not just as actors, but also as business people. And Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, who was not part of Team Anti-Annexation, probably because he really didn't get along very well with Mary Pickford. These people all had studios. They had United Artists, which was a distribution company. They were about to organize the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. These were people that were taking the long view. So I have to think that as this unfolded, and it started very quickly, actually. In 1926, Will Rogers was named the honorary mayor of Beverly Hills. And he used Beverly Hills as the dateline for his column, which is syndicated across the country. I believe he would have become a political candidate at one point if he hadn't died in 1935 in an aviation accident. But by 1930, Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was made one movie but was married to Melvin Douglas, was active in politics. She was a congressman, and she was eventually defeated by Richard Nixon in an election. But she did get to give him the nickname Tricky Dick.
How did the press report this annexation fight? How did the Los Angeles press report it?
Very tongue-in-cheek, like, aren't these people silly? That was pretty much the tone. And, you know, in those days, no paper was afraid of tone, especially the Examiner, especially Hearst's paper. There was one Beverly Hills, or Beverly, stirred over plain water. where the reporter, and there were no bylines on any of these stories. The reporter just sort of said, you know, haven't these people got better things to do than worry about joining Los Angeles and what could possibly be wrong with joining Los Angeles? So it was handled like a joke until a supposed bomb was sent to the editor of the Beverly Hills News, which was probably a prank that he perpetrated on himself to gain attention to the pro-annexation cause. And that, you know, bombs at newspapers, even small weekly newspapers, make news, especially since the 1910 bombing of the Los Angeles Times, which at the time, I think, was the worst terrorist attack that had happened in the United States, and that was in 1910 or 1911, somewhere around there. 1910.
How hard did the city of Los Angeles and its leaders at the time fight for annexation?
They didn't fight for annexation. I think they just assumed it was a foregone conclusion. They left it to the city because the way the civil law in Los Angeles works, the city had to vote. And so I don't think they got involved. I think they wanted it. It was a wealthy enclave, and all those, you know, delightfully wealthy potential taxpayers and ratepayers to the Department of Water and Power lived there. Plus, they could probably had plans to load on tons of assessments. But to my knowledge and in my research, they steered clear of an opinion, at least an overt opinion.
Had the city of Los Angeles been more aggressive, might it have changed the outcome?
Yes, definitely. They were much more aggressive in the second election in Venice, which happened in 1925. They wanted more citizens and they wanted more land. They wanted a larger tax base. I think they were shocked when Beverly Hills voted down annexation, and it was only by 170 votes. I mean, percentage-wise, it was pretty big, but it was like 503 votes against annexation and 370 for annexation. So it was, you know, percentage-wise, it was a big swing, but the number of votes was very small. I think the city of Los Angeles was, quite frankly, shocked. At least that's the way the reportage was, like, what? They don't want to be part of this.
And finally, talk a little bit. You touched on it in terms of the battle that raged most recently over this whole subway issue, mass transit coming through Beverly Hills. But the way in which the echoes of this battle still reverberate, still are in the DNA of the place today.
It's a city that is not afraid to go toe-to-toe with Los Angeles on many different things, whether it's traffic flow in the major streets that bisect both cities, and those are Sunset, Santa Monica Boulevard, Wilshire Boulevard, and Olympic for the most part. They do not want mass transit. They didn't want light rail, for instance. We have some of our new mass transit is ironically replacing the red cars. And it's interesting because In the earliest days of Beverly Hills, they were dying for one of Henry Huntington's trolleys, and they got one, and they were called the Dinky Lines. And then Henry Huntington ran a short little spur from the line that ran along Santa Monica Boulevard up to Sunset to the hotel. But they wanted them gone pretty much after cityhood, and by the 20s they were. They want to remain separate, and they want to remain, they want their separateness to be part of the Southern California consciousness. They don't want people to think Beverly Hills is part of Los Angeles. They want people to know it's a separate city, and they will have ballot initiatives that the traffic implications would impact Los Angeles, and they don't feel any need to share. There was a ballot initiative to build quite a large building, like 10 feet from Los Angeles. And of course, the traffic would impact both cities, but Los Angeles had no say because this is Beverly Hills, it's a separate city. And, you know, I have not attended meetings, but I would say that categorize it maybe as like an armed neutrality. All joking. Nobody's armed. However, you know, the county of Los Angeles takes care of many, you know, the court cases and investigations, and you know, if somebody dies, it's the Los Angeles County Coroner. I know that the city of Los Angeles, the police departments work in concert because so many crimes cross the city border. I know people that have been speeding in Beverly Hills and crossed into Los Angeles and been pulled over by a Beverly Hills policeman who had been following them and said, but you can't give me a ticket, I'm in Los Angeles now, to be told, oh no, we have reciprocity for this. So there are some areas of cooperation, but others where they're just, you know, the density is going to stay low in Beverly Hills, and the density in Los Angeles is going to go to critical mass.
Nancy Clare, her book is The Battle for Beverly Hills, A City's Independence and the Birth of Celebrity Politics. It's just out from St. Martin's Press. Nancy, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me and asking me these wonderful questions.
Thank you.